The way I see it, our emotions are damaged when we turn to ourselves to get our needs met instead of to Jesus. We're born into the world with a lot of needs. We have a hunger drive, and we have a need for shelter. We have a need for love. It's the most basic need that God created, because ultimately that need was to turn us to Him. And that need can only be ultimately fulfilled in God. So that need was there, but when we come into life, it's like we view it as a giant Kmart store, and we take our carts, and some of us head for the sporting goods section, and we try to get all our needs met there. That's where we have our sense of fulfillment, our sense of being needed and of joy, and we just stay in the sporting goods section, just kind of camp out there. Others of us go to the houseware section, and we seek to become the best mothers and the best wives and best homemakers that we can possibly be, because surely we can feel the sense of worth that we need by achieving in that area. Some of us go to the areas where there's trinkets and baubles, and we put them on ourselves and on our walls and try to find fulfillment by things. Also, some of us turn to food. We go to the candy section and just load up the cart and just try to get all our needs met there. And we did all this as little God players, because we weren't aware of God or Jesus. We were just aware of our need. And we begin to develop habit patterns and memory traces. It's something that we did when we just cut God out of the picture and when we were living in our fleshly natures. I want you to turn to Philippians 3, 4 through 6. And this is a picture of Paul's flesh. He's talking in the verse before that about not putting any confidence in our flesh. He says, though I myself have reason for such confidence. If anyone else thinks he has reason to put confidence in the flesh, I have more. I was circumcised on the eighth day of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, in regard to the law, a Pharisee, as for zeal, persecuting the church, as for legalistic righteousness, faultless. He had probably some of the best-looking flesh that anyone had developed on planet Earth. He was righteous, he was pure, and he was fleshly. And it's so hard for us to see that sometimes our motives behind doing some of the things we do are selfish motives. I think some of Paul's motives were probably for his own self-esteem, his own self-acceptance that he had to do some of these things, the acceptance of his peers and of God. But when Paul was saved, he says that he became a new creature. And in verse 7, it says, whatever was to my profit, I now consider loss for the sake of Christ. Some of our fleshly patterns go away when we're saved. Maybe there's a habit or a burden or a care that God just lifts away from us at the moment of our salvation. There's other things that He allows to stay in our life so that we can work out our salvation, so that the reality of our salvation can become effective. It talks about this in Hebrews 5, 8, and 9. You might turn to that. Because His own Son did this. It says, although He was a son, He learned obedience from what He suffered. And once made perfect, He became the source of eternal salvation to those who obey Him. Jesus came, and He was perfect in His person, but He had to become perfect in His vocation. And He had to work that out through His obedience to His Father. So some of these things that stay with us and seem so difficult to bear, God leaves there for a certain purpose. In Judges 3, 1 and 2, He talks about the nations that were left after the Israelites settled into their new kingdom. He says, these are the nations the Lord left to test all those Israelites who had not experienced any of the wars in Canaan. He did this only to teach warfare to the descendants of the Israelites who had not had previous battle experience. So some of the things that he leaves is to give us some battle experience, to allow us to learn spiritual warfare. But what happens a lot of times is that we don't like this. We don't like the pain that's left. We see that in his word he promised certain things, and so we begin to try to implement those promises ourselves into our own life. My husband bought a riding lawnmower the other day, and the reason he bought it at a particular place was because they promised to come to the house to make repairs. Well, this was just, you know, heavenly. Neither one of us are mechanical at all, and this just seemed like the perfect setup. So he made the deal, bought the lawnmower, and sure enough, the first day we had it, something went wrong, and here came the little man right out. We thought, what a deal, you know, this is perfect. And when he was out of town the other day, my son had had a flat on it, and I thought, why don't I call and get this repaired while he's gone, and it'll just, you know, he'll be so pleased with me. This will be done, and it'll be out of the way, a little worry that I can take care of. I called, and the lady on the telephone just flatly said, we don't do that. I don't know where you got that idea. That is ridiculous, but we don't come to the house to do repairs. I just kind of went, but you said, well, but, you know. And she said, no, that's just not our policy. So needless to say, I was angry when I hung up the phone. But I had to stop and think. I didn't make that deal. My husband made the deal. I didn't even know the man he made the deal with or worked it out with. And so I really didn't have any plea to make. I just had to accept the fact that they weren't going to come and fix it. That was in their power to say no, and it wasn't in my power to make a claim. And I thought how close that is to what we do to God sometimes. We have a habit or we have a painful emotion that we don't want there. And so we say, okay, you know, God, let's, you know, dial this number right here. It says in verse such and such that you will, come on, do it. Come and fix me. You promised to make house calls. And I think that that's adulterating the Word of God. I mean, we try to make Him fit into our life. And it's hard for us to let go and think, now that's His responsibility. He's the one that made the deal. He's the one that can work it out. And so we don't rest in His provision. We take our lives and we think, well, okay, I'll handle it. I see He's not going to help me in this area of being a submissive wife, so I'll do it. I'm sure I can handle it. And I don't think He's going to help me to quit yelling at my kids, so I'll do that. So we put ourselves under tight control, and our life becomes, you know, those little plastic puzzles that have the little holes all around in them, and there might be four or five little balls that you roll around in the plastic puzzle, and you have to get the balls into the hole, and you get a couple of balls in, and you tip it to try to get another ball or two in, and the other balls roll out, and you just become, you know, your life becomes trying to get the balls all in the hole at the same time. And I think few of us have ever gotten all the balls in the hole at one time. And sometimes I have to stop myself and think, you know, am I just trying to get a ball in the hole? I just relate to that so completely because I'm just frantically trying to make things work out my way. What this basic need that I talked about needing to feel loved and to be loved, is so basic in our life that as we come into our marriages, we might come into our marriage not feeling loved from our past, and we're way down here in the sense of feeling loved. But we have an idea of what it would be if we were loved. Why, he would do this, and he would do that, and some of it might be things that our fathers had done for us when we were little. Maybe he always remembered our birthday. And so if I'm loved, if my husband loves me, he will remember my birthday. So we have a hidden agenda, and it's way up here. And the gap is so big between that we feel loved and the expressions it takes to show us love, that the demands get greater and greater, and it gets harder and harder for us to see love, because if we happen to share it, if we happen to, you know, verbalize how we felt and I need this, then that's not quite fair. He should be able to read my mind, know what I need, and just do those things so that I would feel loved. And I think the only solution in a scale like that of when we don't feel loved is to put ourselves in Jesus' hand and just have our needs met in Him and allow that balance to come to where it just doesn't take such extreme expressions of love for us to feel loved. It's been said that the level of our anxiety is directly proportional to how many things we have to do right to feel good about ourselves. Because in this part down here where I was explaining in our relationship with our husband of where we feel unloved, it can also be something about how we feel about ourselves. We just feel like we're pretty rotten, you know, pretty unredeemable. And so we expect things of ourselves that are way up here. We expect perfection, you know, we expect ourselves to be able to be more than human. And it does the same thing as it does in our relationships. It's the kind of approach that we have to ourselves. And we haven't learned with Paul to say that in me dwells no good thing. We're not convinced of that. We think that there's something left. There's something there that I can do to make myself like myself. Now, I talked about damaged emotions being those emotions that turn us to ourself to get our needs met instead of to Jesus. It tells us over and over in the scriptures that we're going to suffer and that we're going to experience pain in life. So a damaged emotion can't just be any painful emotion. It says in Romans 8:17, it says, "Now if we are children, then we are heirs, heirs of God, co-heirs with Christ, if indeed we share in his sufferings, in order that we may also share in his glory." Over and over, the word tells us that we're going to suffer. But we're also told in like 1 Peter 5:7 that we are to cast all our cares on him because he cares for us. And that we're also supposed to, like in Psalm 50:15, "Call upon me in the day of trouble, and I will deliver thee, and thou shalt glorify me." So there's a reason sometimes for some of our troubles. We're supposed to turn to Jesus and allow him to meet. And we do that sometimes with some things. It's amazing. Sometimes we can go through a huge tragedy and just rest in his grace and just be, you know, flooded with his mercy and carried through with just the abundance that he gives us to get through that trial. But then it's the little everyday things that it's so hard to trust him with. We begin to feel so hopeless and so like we'll never get fixed. "Just as my child brings his broken toy with tears for me to mend, I took all my broken dreams to God because he was my friend. But then instead of leaving him in peace to work alone, I hung around and tried to help with ways that were my own. At last I snatched them back and cried, 'How could you be so slow?' 'What could I do, my child?' he said. 'You never did let go.'" The two most basic needs that a child has to be able to sense that he's loved and adored is time and touch. We hear that from Christian counselors and from psychiatrists and psychologists. And we know that this child needs that kind of time and touch. We've heard stories about babies dying in hospitals because they didn't receive the kind of touch, physical affection that they needed. So a healthy amount of time spent drawing a child out to know him for who he is and help him to define his emotions and the touch are vital in life. I grew up in a young preacher's family, and he was busy starting a Baptist mission and busy with his life. And I came out of that without feeling loved. I was also supposed to be a boy, and I blew it, you know, just by being born. And I lived my life with a sense of desperation. A child feels that if they feel unloved or they feel a certain way, it's because they are unlovely or they are the bad ones. They can't think, "Now, I'm sorry that parent can't express love to me. I know he really loves me, but he's just not expressing it to me in a way that I can understand." They just don't have that capacity to reason, so they just think, "I'm unlovable. If I don't feel loved, the only reason is that I'm unlovable. I'm unlovely, and I'm unlovable. And that's the tapes that played over and over in my mind as I grew up. I carried around a big sense of guilt and inadequacy because I had in my mind what I needed to be loved. If I could just be these things, they would love me. If I could just be these things, I would feel lovable. I took this sense of guilt and inadequacy to my Savior, and He became my Savior and met my needs and saved me. But somehow, as time progressed, as a young child, I began to put Him on the same kind of acceptance as I had my parents on. And I felt like if I was these things to Him, then He would love me. And I came out of it feeling like He didn't. And I came out of it feeling like He would somehow, someday, surely just throw up His hands and walk out the door. How could He keep putting up with this kind of a person that I felt like I was? Of course, the reason for that is because Satan doesn't give up easily. I don't know if any of you have read Screwtape Letters, but he talks, it's a conversation with a daddy demon to a lesser demon, and this one demon totally blows it, and his victim becomes a Christian. Well, the daddy demon says, well, you blew it, you know, but you still have some chances, you know, just defeat him in every turn, help him to feel like that when he prays, his prayers aren't answered, just to feel that way. So one of the greatest areas in life that Satan has to work in is in the area of our emotions. And that's where the spiritual battle is won and fought, especially, I think, as women. You know, I think men too, but especially as women, he attacks our emotions. I began to learn to straddle the fence in life. I needed so much that I, you know, at school and with my friends, I would be one thing to get their approval. I loved it when they would be shocked when they found out I was a preacher's daughter. Oh, you're a preacher's daughter. Yes, you know. And then I would be at church and I'd get the little pats on the head about what a wonderful little Christian girl you are. You're going to be somebody someday, you know. How precious you are. And I just ate it up. I needed all of that. And so I began to learn to live with a divided heart and in two kingdoms. And I was going to get my needs met by God, but I was going to make sure that I got my needs met myself in my own way. And I made a decision. I made a decision that I would show myself and I would show my parents just how lovable I could be. I could be perfect. And in a sense, this was just a turning away from them. If they weren't going to love me, I would show them. In The Kingdom of Self, Earl Jubay says, what God is concerned about is the damage of opposition to authority and what it does to the person giving such opposition. We are damaged, not God. So when we say, all right, God, you know, you didn't come through for me, so I will meet my needs my way. It's not the damage it brings to God. It's the damage that we bring to ourselves. There were a few people in my life that didn't catch on to my wonderfulness, and those were my teachers. Those were my authority figures in my life, and I always felt like they saw right through me. And so I did all I could to try to please, and of course I constantly blew it because I was also trying to please my peers. You know, sometimes the twain shall never meet. You know, when you're acting out to please your peers, the teachers don't really appreciate it. When I was in third grade, I got a paste lid stuck on my little finger. You know those little jars of paste that have the little metal lids and the stem of the paste spreader is sticking up through the lid and it has a little hole in it, kind of like a donut? Well, I was in class one day and, you know, just working this down and I got it stuck on my little finger. And I remember just sitting there, hanging out under the desk, thinking, what am I going to do? You know, I twisted and turned and, you know, tried to get it loose and it would not come loose. Well, I already knew and was convinced that Miss Brown hated me. So I couldn't go to Miss Brown with this. It would just be another strike against me. So I excused myself to the restroom and took my paste lid and my hand into the restroom and went to the sink and got all the soap on it I could and started working with it, trying to get it. It was starting to cut into my finger and I was just getting frantic and panicky. And I must have been in there quite a while because here came Miss Brown. And she looked down at me and, you know, what is the situation? And I just said, well, you know, I've got this payslip stuck on my finger. And she took my hand and took me into the principal's office. And here were these adults standing over this child. And I felt like they were just glaring at me. I thought maybe fire was coming out of their eyes. And they were just, how could she have done this? You know, and I just felt devastated that I'd done something so stupid because I needed so desperately to be perfect. So, of course, they got the wire cutters out and cut the paste lid off, and I was free. I was free from the paste lid, but I wasn't free from myself. That little incident, Satan used that to just put a stamp on me and say, do you see what you really are? Let's pick up this charade bit. You know, we can't go around getting paste lids stuck on our finger or getting in trouble at school. You know, you're blowing your charade. You know, let's get going. So I just tried and tried to put on more perfection because I really despised the real me. And control became the issue of my life. I decided that if I could just control myself, control the things I said or did, or control how I acted in certain crowds, that I could just kind of pick up a little bit of acceptance wherever I was. I was exhausted. By the time I reached the summer before my 10th grade year, we moved to a completely new town and state, and I thought, boy, this is a clean slate. This is the chance I have in a lifetime to be good. So I made up my mind to be good. I would be good to friends. I would be good to teachers. I would make good grades. I just did all the good stuff I could, and it worked. What was amazing was that it worked. I made good grades in school. I was very popular. I did all the things that I thought I needed to do to be fulfilled. But I wasn't fulfilled. I knew the real me down inside. And in my senior year of high school, I plunged into what would be 5 years of bulimia. There wasn't a name for it then. I just had my head in the toilet, and I just thought I was crazy. But as long as my head was in the toilet, as long as I was out of control in the privacy of my own life, I knew that was the real me. The person that the people liked, the person that, even the person that loved God, was so shallow and so fake that I had to show myself who the real me was. And so she just kept her head in the toilet. And so for 5 years I struggled with that. And how God must have grieved as he saw this child that he gave his life for, as he saw this little person who he wanted so desperately to show his love to, as he saw her try so hard to meet her own needs and fail so miserably, because we will fail. We just can't. Yeah, instead, I looked to my own self, and I hated what I saw. But I made another decision. I decided that if grades and popularity and all that didn't bring me the satisfaction that I longed to have, then certainly marriage and money would. So I checked around, and I found a guy that had some money and, you know, a neat guy, and we got married. And I thought I could come into that marriage and make a decision like I did when I went into my sophomore year of high school to be good. I could certainly, you know, marriage would somehow be another dividing line, and I could step through it, and I wouldn't be me anymore, and I could get out of my bulimic behavior, and I could change. But I couldn't. I was so desperately into the compulsive behavior that I couldn't change. And the worst of it all was that I was still me. I wanted somehow to just not be me anymore. I demanded perfection of myself, and I demanded perfection of those who were around me. I demanded of God to give me something that he couldn't give me in that position. And he just waited patiently for me to come to the end of myself. My charade was real good, and I decided that since marriage and money hadn't worked and we were becoming rather unhappy in our marriage, that maybe children would be the answer. And so we had 5 children in 6.5 years. And I thought, well, you know, when I decided to do something, I decided to do it good. And God was good to me during these years. Even though I had him on a performance-based acceptance, I had blessings. I mean, there were victories. But the defeat seemed to so far outweigh them that just emotionally I became more desperate. worked my way out of bulimia, I think through the years that I had children, because I knew that you couldn't do this to a life living within you. You know, you couldn't destroy their life and yours. And so God used that time to deliver me from that compulsive behavior. But now my choices were affecting six other people in life. And I had to make all those balls balance in that little game. And I blew it constantly. I couldn't make hardly any of the balls stay in. And I had a terrible time making decisions because every decision was so important. I mean, our life hung in the balance of my decisions, I honestly felt like. My submission, as Irma talked about this morning, the verse that God showed me about my submission was that in the Psalms he said that even my enemies submit to me with feigned and reluctant obedience. And I saw that that was what I was doing to my husband. I was submitting to him with a feigned obedience because basically I couldn't stand him. I couldn't stand him any more than I could stand myself. And I wanted him to be all that I couldn't be. I wanted him to be everything for me that my life was unable to give me. And I needed him so desperately that our marriage just began to crumble. And he began to turn to his own ways to get his needs met, and a lot of that was just making more money. And I was desperate, and our marriage, it was falling apart. And I prayed for him constantly. I prayed for him mainly the things that I wanted changed. And one day I was praying some of those things. I said, "Oh, Lord, just look at this, and oh, look at, and he does this, and please keep, oh, he just, you know." And the Lord showed me in John 15:7, where it says, "If you abide in me, and my words abide in you, you shall ask what you will, and it shall be done unto you." And I said, "Oh, that's right, Lord, just look at this. Look at, he does this, and it shall be done unto you. And look at this." And the Lord said, "Read that again. If you abide in me, and my words abide in you, you shall ask what you will, and it shall be done unto who?" And I just went, "Unto who? Unto you." And it was unto me. And God just told me then, he said, "I am perfectly capable of working in your husband's life without your help. We're going to work on you." And somehow he gave me the grace to let go. Somehow he gave me the grace for that not to mean quite so much. And I was able to just let go of those desperate prayers that I prayed and the things that I thought I needed so desperately in order to have my life fulfilled. And our marriage began to mend and things began to change. And we know now that it was totally by God's grace. And sometimes we just look at each other and we just know that it's God's grace that mended our marriage. You think nobody can see camouflaged misery? Well, now, Jesus knows. All those things you try to hide from him, he died for every one of them. I was finally able to open up to a friend and just share with her what had been going on in our life. I was finally able to open up enough. Maybe the pain got so great that I had to share what kind of a person I was, what kind of a mother I was, what kind of a wife I'd been, and how I felt about all that. And she just looked at me and she just said, "Well, you need to be free." Well, she could have been speaking in Russian. I mean, that word, free, there was nothing for me to relate to it in my life. There was just nothing there to understand what free meant. I had spent my whole life controlling who I was, controlling every action and every word, and trying to control every feeling and failing. So I couldn't imagine that you could actually let go. And she sent me a book several months after we had talked, and it was called God's Crippled Children. It was by a woman named Lana Bateman, and she has a ministry in Dallas called Philippian Ministries. And basically it's a ministry that helps Christians who just can't get any victory and whose pain, they're just too great to keep going on. I read Lana's book, and basically the first part of her book is her life story, and I related totally. Our lives were completely different, but the pain was the same. And for the first time in my life, I guess I thought I was the only one experiencing this kind of craziness and suffering, and I saw that there was someone else who had lived that kind of a life and that they had an answer. and I had hope. And my husband and I talked, and he looked at the book, and I knew that I had to get this kind of help. We were living in Chicago at the time, and yet he let me make an appointment with a counselor and go to see this woman for emotional healing. And as I talked and I prayed through my life with my counselor, I began to see how Satan had taken advantage of a little girl who just needed to be loved. He had made self the most important thing to me, and he made me blind to Jesus' provision and his presence. In Ephesians 1, 4, and 5, it says, "For he chose us in him before the creation of the world to be holy and blameless in his sight. In love he predestined us to be adopted as his sons through Jesus Christ in accordance with his pleasure and will." What this verse says to me is that God views life as a helicopter. From a helicopter, he sees our life, you know, in its totality. Some of us, I used to think that when I became a Christian, God began to be able to see me. He began to be able to notice that I existed. But when I see that we are chosen in him before the creation of the world, I know that he had to see my past as well as my present and my future. So we see life as, you know, we're born, we grow up, we become a Christian, we walk on through life, and we can only see it a step at a time, but he sees it completely and totally. We prayed through my life, and as we prayed, I began to see why I had done the things I had done. And, I mean, most of it was sin. I mean, there was no excusing, and there was no denying that, you know, the things that I had done and the means that I had used to try to get my needs met were wrong. But I began to see why, and I began to learn to fight the spiritual battle and to have choices. In Psalm 139, the precious psalm, it says, "Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I made my bed in the depths, you, Lord, are there. You are there, Jesus." You remember the little incident with the paste lid? I mean, it just seemed like such a ridiculous incident. How could that scar someone's life? I mean, good grief. But I could see in that incident that what I did when the adults were towering over me was that Satan just made me turn inward. I could only turn inward and hate what I saw. And as we prayed through that little incident, I could see the truth about the incident, that Jesus was there, that he was with me through that incident, and he was understanding. He understood that I was just a little girl, and that I just got a paste lid stuck on my finger, that I hadn't really done anything wrong. The wrong came when I turned against self instead of to Jesus, who was available to me every moment. And I began to see that in my life, everything that I did, he was there. His presence was there. And, you know, he tells us that we shall know the truth, and the truth shall make us free. And part of the truth that we can see is that in situations in our life, that he saw and knew about and understood, that we didn't cover them up. You know, there was nothing in our life that could cover that incident up. And he saw, and he understood, and he doesn't condemn. He only wants those situations to draw us to him. And so often we use our own means. And where Satan condemns, Jesus understands. In Colossians 2:15 it says, "And having disarmed the powers and authorities, he made a public spectacle of them on the cross, triumphing." Well, Satan's no match for Jesus, and he could no longer have a hold on my life because I had believed him instead of the truth about this situation and many others like it. The father of lies had made me my own worst enemy. And Jesus promises to set us free. He promises to set us free from self and from Satan and from our need to be loved and adored. And when he told me the truth about my past, that he knew about it all along, and this charade that I had played and this love that I had tried to earn was just so freely available the whole time, it was healing. And like we say in our ministry, that healing can be instant, but health is a process. So one of the most basic truths that we learn in our ministry is how to fight the spiritual battle. And I don't know if you've heard about how to do that, but that's why I gave you these little orange booklets. And many of us may not have scars deep enough that we need something as drastic as emotional healing. But we all need to learn to fight the spiritual battle. And we all need to learn how Satan works and just be aware of his tactics. So I want you to open your little orange book. And I couldn't find anything better to explain how to fight the spiritual battle. So I felt like this was something that we could just look at and then keep it with you. I've gone many miles with this book. When things just kind of crash in around me, I just get out and walk. And I usually come back and the battle's won. It was won before I left by Jesus. And this just helps me to appropriate it. The first statement at the top of it's at the top of page 3, but the first page of the text is, spiritual battles are won or lost at the threshold of the mind, not in the mind. And it gives some scriptures. The first one, Isaiah 26:3, says, the steadfast of mind thou will keep in perfect peace because he trusts in thee. And on over to page 4, a scripture that you probably know very well. It says, we are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God, and we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. Be anxious in nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension, shall guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Well, the ultimate intention of having our minds set on spiritual things is that we can be renewed in the spirit of our mind. And the Bible tells us over and over that this is a serious warfare. I really believe that in the Psalms, the battles that they had to fight and the emotions that David experienced when he fought these battles and that the psalmist shares with us are the same kind of battles that we fight with this unseen enemy. It tells us in Ephesians 6, 12 and 13a, on page 5, for our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the full armor of God. It's a serious warfare. And I think that sometimes when we hear words like healing and spiritual battle, it kind of seems hocus-pocus to us or just a little bit spooky, and we don't really understand what it's trying to say and how we can apply it to our everyday life. This quote at the bottom of this page has meant so much to me. It says that the Lord cannot do much with a dejected soul. Therefore, the adversary attempts to push the Lord's children into despair and hopelessness over their own condition or the condition of those around them. He will magnify and give false interpretation to our problems. Try to think of a problem that's current in your life right now. Maybe with a child, it might be with your husband, it might be with yourself. And try to picture how hugely the enemy has magnified that problem in your life. He's probably given you no hope. And you're probably already defeated and condemned. Or that child is probably already in jail, you know, already gone to reform school. In our minds, I mean, we just get into such a hopeless state. It says we cannot resist the wiles of the enemy while in this state, nor prevail in prayer for others. We need to understand these attacks of the enemy upon our minds and how to resist them. It talks about focusing on disappointments and how when we're disappointed, this spirals down into despair and depression and demoralization. I used to feel like, honestly, that if I was experiencing something like depression, it was like I had been standing on the seashore and a huge tidal wave had just come and bowled me over. I didn't know where it had come from. I didn't know if it was ever going to go away. I just knew it was there. I didn't understand that there were steps that I used, that I took, that had gotten me into that position, and that I could come against. It says that Satan will spare no effort to tempt, deceive, and accuse me if it will result in my choosing to focus my mind on something, anything, other than Christ and Him alone. And that's the whole crux of damaged emotions. We experience those feelings. We can't endure the pain. And so instead of going to Christ with them, you know, they turn us away from Him. The thing that we have to remember, too, is that Satan is a defeated foe and that we don't have to obey him anymore. The most basic thing that happened for me as I went through emotional healing was that my life began to have some choices. I never had choices before. If I was angry, I was just angry. It was like I didn't have a choice to not be angry. When I was bulimic, I didn't feel like I had a choice. It was out of my power to combat that behavior. I didn't feel like I had choices. But on the bottom of page 6, it begins to talk about how we have our mental processes like two channels. And channel 1 is when we follow Satan's suggestions and desires for our life. And that results in anger, disappointment, hostility, inferiority, any of the negative, super negatives. And channel 2 is to follow Christ's will and goals for my life. And channel 1 is walking after the flesh, and channel 2 is walking in the Spirit. And so often, especially as women, we feel like that walking in the Spirit is a feeling concept. And if we don't feel like we're walking in the Spirit, then we must not be. But it's something that we choose to do and set our mind on. And he gives the example that probably you've heard before about, you know, the alarm clock rings and you don't want to get up and you have to choose to get up. Well, when that thought comes into our mind or that emotion seems to overflow us, we have to choose whether we're going to give in to it or not. If we do live by our emotions, on top of page 8, it talks about how we destine ourselves for a roller coaster experience in life. And how he says we must get up and walk in the complete assurance and firm conviction that Christ has taken care of the situation whether I feel any differently or not. In the bottom part of verse John 16:33, it talks about, I have deprive the world of power to harm. I have conquered it for you. Now we need to look at how sin disguises himself. And the power of sin is, I think, just another name for Satan. Capital S-I-N is another name for him. It says that he disguises himself as my old dead self and addresses me in first-person pronouns. Debbie, you're depressed. In simple terms, this means that it will seem as though I am coming up with these thoughts of depression, impurity, selfishness, and covetousness. This, of course, leaves me wide open for what seems to be self-condemnation for thinking such crummy thoughts. So essentially what he does, he puts the thought in our mind, and then he condemns us for thinking it. And this is, I would end up on my knees so many times, oh Lord, you know, look at me again. Look at where I am. I've thought this thing, or I've felt this thing. And I would be trying to confess, and all it would do would just compound the problem, because I needed to learn to recognize where the thought was coming from and where the condemnation was coming from. It talks about the kind of the steps that you need to go through to do this on page 9. First of all, we have to recognize when a condemning thought comes against us, that it's attacking our character. It's accusing us and confusing us, and it's a thought that will lead to our destruction, and which is not true. I used to have a lot of suicidal thoughts, and those were certainly destructive. We can refuse to accept the thought as yours, and you can, upon the which to dwell, we just don't have to keep it in our mind. We can recognize where it's coming from, and we can reckon ourselves dead to sin. Because our true desire is not to follow sin. And so just as a dead person, we learn that we don't have to follow sin's thoughts or accusations. We can learn to rest in the fact that we're in Christ and that He's in me. It's only through Christ that we can accomplish these things. Self will never get it. This is a perfect book. I would really just recommend that you just meditate on it and just get it into your life. There's a whole series of questions at the back of the book that'll help you to learn to fight the spiritual battle. Some of you might not be able to. You know, some of you, even with these tools, might need a little more. Because he tells us over and over that we need to draw near to him. In Hebrews it talks about how, you know, we need to draw near to the throne of grace to receive his mercy and to find grace to help us in times of need. So when we find ourselves unable to draw near, when we find ourselves unable to approach him, then we need to realize that it's probably a spiritual battle. You know, that if we feel so ashamed and there's something we have to fix before we get to him. I read a quote that was written way back in the, I think, 1600s the other day, and I want to share it with you. Our Heavenly Father, so far from ever overlooking us, is only waiting to find our hearts open, to pour into them the torrents of his grace.